This is CliffCentral.com.
It's just after 8 o'clock, CliffCentral.com. A busy morning today, and we're very, very excited to speak to Marcus Swanepoel in a moment. He's the co-founder and CEO of Luno. It's part of our media partnership with Blockchain Africa Conference. And let me tell you quickly about the conference. They've got an incredible range of speakers, including Marcus. They've got Anrik Dazeman, who is the senior fintech specialist at the South African Reserve Bank. Helen Zeller will be speaking there too. She's, of course, the Premier of the Western Cape. And Simon Dingle, who's the CEO of Invest Capital. Brian Behlendorf, who's the Executive Director of Linux Foundation's Hyperledger Project, which has been named one of the top 10 influential voices in the blockchain world in a New York Times commentary titled "The People Leading the Blockchain Revolution." The conference will take place in Joburg at the Wanderers Club, 28 Feb to 1 March. So if you haven't got your tickets yet, you need to get them ASAP. The conference in Cape Town is at the Cape Town ICC from the 6th of March 2019, and you can get tickets by going to blockchainafrica.co, or you can email info@blockchainafrica.co. I can't make it much easier for you than that. If you need help, if you need more than that, you need to rewind the podcast. I can't do everything for you. All right? I can only push this rock up this hill so far. Now, after spending 10 years in finance and being interested in tech for a very long time, it became obvious to Marcus Swanepoel he would have to start something with Bitcoin. Fast forward to today, and Marcus is leading the future of money as he's the CEO of Luno, had many lessons along the way. He'll also be sharing some of those lessons this morning and at the 5th Blockchain Africa Annual Conference, which is taking place in Joburg and in Cape Town. So Marcus, it's a pleasure to meet you, man.
Same, Gary. Thank you. I actually realized we've met before. But
I thought that when I saw you.
But that was about 20 years ago when you were still at Radio Tux at News Cafe in Menlyn in Pretoria.
Jesus. Well, if only I'd known that you were going to be so successful, I would have made more of an effort.
Early days.
I would have been much nicer. You know, I would have, hey, Marcus. What did we meet?
I think you guys were doing some event there. But I grew up next to the Radio Tux studio. And for some reason, whenever I phoned through to competitions, I would always get through first. So my whole shelf was just packed with Radio Tux freebies.
Prizes.
Very stupid prizes, but I got them all. I think there was some short circuit in the system.
I'm just blown away with what you've done since then. That must be 20-odd years ago. Mm. And the things that have happened since then are just phenomenal. You've lived in Palo Alto. You've lived in Singapore. You're actually a permanent resident there as well, right? And Luno, we did a really interesting series with you guys last year about cryptocurrency, because for a lot of people, it's still quite complicated and they're not entirely sure how it works. And they want to get in, but they don't know whether they are getting in at the right time, and they're being persuaded by stupid things like prices rather than the underlying technology. Mm. And there are a lot of charlatans in this world too. I mean, you must have encountered, because you started this journey right in the beginning when only a few people in Silicon Valley were talking about Bitcoin. And now you hear everybody's an expert. I mean, most of them aren't, but you hear a lot of people talking about it like they know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And the banks are getting involved, and everybody's, it's just turned into this monstrous thing.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. We just published a blog piece, I think 2 days ago, on which crypto influencers to trust and how to make sure that you don't trust the wrong people. And, you know, when someone spoke to me like a year or two ago about what is the biggest thing you've learned so far from going on this journey, it was actually about how it came down to kind of fake news and how misconceptions are headlined in the media about in our industry, for example, right? So there's a lot of risks and a lot of opportunities. But just sitting inside the industry and seeing what's going on, and then on a day-to-day basis, reading what either the media are saying or certain so-called influencers and so on, that got me really scared about the reality of other things in life. You know, if I'm reading about the Middle East or about politics.
Think about politics or about the world economy.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm trusting certain sources to give me good information, but those same sources were writing things about our industry that were factually incorrect, but by quite a large degree. So I think that opened my eyes a little bit. It's a little bit unrelated to the whole crypto thing, but it is something I think that's become quite topical in our time. So, and hopefully this technology can play a role in kind of helping to validate the truth.
Well, that's it. And what I'm always impressed by is that people like you placed your bets years and years ago, and you decided you were going to learn as much as you could. And that curiosity is, for me, the defining factor of why some people are successful and others are not. And it basically comes from a desire to know more.
Yeah.
I mean, you went off to Palo Alto. You set up shop there, you didn't have any plan. You were going to just see what was happening. You knew that all the big thinkers, all the big technology companies were based there. And your timing was good, but you also had no idea of whether or not you would stumble upon a good idea. You might have ended up, you know, like Bernie Sanders, living on someone's sofa for the rest of your life.
I did live on a sofa for 3 or 4 years, even in the beginning of this.
So how did that
journey
work?
But yeah, I mean, just to be clear, that you know, it wasn't, you know, Mark is going to Palo Alto and then da-da, some big idea, you know, like with anything else, this is built by teams and a lot of different people that get together. So there's a lot of, you know, there were actually 5 founders of the company and we all got together at the same time, each with their own story. I was, you know, in Palo Alto, one of my co-founders, Timothy, is our CTO and really the brains behind building the entire, you know, technology part of the business. Mm-hmm. He was an engineer with Google in Switzerland, but also South African. Peter, Carl, a couple of guys together. And through a common friend, we all got together more or less at the same time. And, you know, the guy said, look, you're all thinking about the same things. You're all thinking about crypto. You all want to do something. You all have quite a complementary skill set. Why don't you all kind of meet and see, you know, what can be done? And so we ended up kind of spending time together and we realized, wow, you know, this is the team that can take things forward. And like you say, at the time, it was more curiosity. You know, it's easy in hindsight to go, oh, we, you know, from day one knew exactly how this thing's going to work out. Like, you don't really know. But,
no. But
you know, we saw this new technology and we knew what the internet had done to information, disseminating information and democratizing that. And it just felt obvious that if there was this new technology to be able to transfer value across the planet on one platform in a way that's really trusted and transparent, it feels that would be quite useful. Mm. And if you look at kind of just the macro view of a lot of technologies, you know, a lot of it, like the internet, it's just society kind of building economies of scale and efficiencies into the system. So it felt like an obvious thing to explore at least. And, you know, I think the point you make about the curiosity, I was speaking to someone yesterday and they were talking about the Bitcoin price again, which people like to talk about. And I say to them, but you know what? You know, one of the really good measures for you to measure the health of the industry and where it's going is look at the talent going into the industry. If you go to Silicon Valley now, still, it is by far the most popular sector for people to get into. I mean, people are fighting to work for crypto and blockchain companies. The quality of people joining Luno is astounding. I mean, you can't believe that this caliber of people, and we're talking, you know, we're hiring people from the biggest banks, the biggest law firms, Google, Amazon, you know, fantastic people. And that's happening across the world for all crypto and blockchain companies. So if you have so many young, talented, curious people wanting to make that change, it, you know, it can almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy, even just with this momentum of human capital.
What I love about the potential of blockchain technology and the potential of having these shared ledgers and this trusted system is that it can't be corrupted by a single person with bad intention, like, you know, everything else in human society always is. And the fact that there isn't a central repository of authority that can make a, you know, diktat that goes out and that everybody suffers from or benefits from, it's pretty much... This is the real word community in technological action.
Yeah. No, it's exactly. Look, I think we also, you know, we don't come from the school of thought where we, you know, banks and governments are evil and everything centralized is evil. I think it's important to realize why many of those institutions exist. And over time, a lot of them have just kind of grown so big and maybe not adapted themselves to the world we live in today in terms of democracy and
they've calcified.
Yeah, and rights and expectations from consumers, for example, how fast things should happen and so on. So I think, you know, we were speaking about it the other day and it's, you know, we can't be angry at these institutions because we built them. We mm-hmm. we voted governments in to build them. We supported them.
And people left them to do what they didn't want to do. So inevitably what they end up doing is accumulating more and more power and authority to themselves.
And it's not...
Most people don't care. Most people don't even know what the interest rate is.
No, and it's not... There's not some Mr. Evil banker sitting behind his desk trying to, you know, manipulate the world, whatever. It's institutionalized. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with it. And you'll probably see, even on these, you know, building these distributed systems, they will still be, you know, a place for centralized authorities, people that want to trust certain parties to help them on their journey. So, for example, people have to trust Luno to help them on their journey, and we are centralized, but we're giving people access to something that's decentralized. So I think a mix is always healthy.
Please tell me right up front, there's not going to be a situation where if you die or something, then everyone's Bitcoin is going to disappear, like it happened just a couple of days ago, where a whole cache of Bitcoin was just
not even close.
The guy who had the key died, and everybody's money was wiped out.
I mean, that was. I mean, that's crypto 101. We were all astounded when we saw that because, and you know, this is part of the problem. There's, like you said, there's so many kind of charlatans out there and people taking chances, and you know and that's why you have to do your due diligence on who you're storing your money with. You know, if you're walking in the street and someone says, you know, I can store your 200 Rand for you. Do you mind? You know, do you want to keep it with me? You're not going to just give it to some stranger. No. You're going to say, like, where are you from? Have you done this before? And so on. So I think that's a good example of, you know, no one should have trusted them in the first place had they known how their whole security worked, and they could have asked. So our systems definitely don't work like that. It's a lot more sophisticated.
Not one person who has everything, and if they die, everything's
not even one. I mean, there's multiple. I mean, I don't want to go into all the detail, but you know, we store this stuff in multiple physical vaults around the world on multiple continents, and not one person has access to all of it. I don't even know where some of them are. There's multiple access controls for everything, so it's you know, there's a lot of stuff that makes sure that won't happen. But it is it's a bit of a schoolboy error, but could happen.
Well, I'm proud of the fact that so many South Africans made something like this that created a business and a way for people all over the world to be able to buy and sell cryptocurrency, to be able to store it in a wallet, to be able to partake in this new economy. And it came from here. It came from a bunch of guys who are homegrown. There's not a lot that we can be proud of that's still here, because all our best brains are being exported. We're losing our cleverest people almost on a daily basis. And for you guys to have come up with this, I think is going to rank right up there with the Elon Musks and the rest of them when we eventually get to doing a proper accounting. It's just, it's taking...
I mean, we were even surprised about how quickly the industry grew in South Africa. Mm. And not just Luno, there's so many exciting companies in the crypto and blockchain space. There's stuff coming out of University of Stellenbosch.
Right.
Some of the earliest people in Ethereum are sitting in Stellenbosch. We've got Fluffy Pony, who's, you know, the Monero. Leader of Monero. And so South Africa is actually an outsized group of entrepreneurs and people in this industry. And even in San Francisco, I'm there next week, I'm meeting some of the top San Francisco companies, and some of the senior people in those companies also are South Africans. So there's this weird South African network, South African mafia in the crypto industry. We've got Rand from, you know, CNBC that does all of that stuff. So it's a very interesting dynamic, and it's definitely overweight relative to our population size or our previous successes in technology. So, and these are the type of things that we need to hold on to and go for.
But do you think that's also because we've watched our northern neighbor and various other countries, Venezuela most recently, where we've seen their economies completely collapse, and people's currency, the thing that they believe their money is going to be accounted in and safe, you know, within the confines of, and that they understand the value of this, and then it all collapses, and people are going, well, you know what, I'd rather go with something that seems to be in a technological space that has some verification, that has an ability to account for itself, that is not controlled by any one single institution, Reserve Bank or anything else. People are looking at that stuff because they've seen examples in the world that we're living in right now where they go, actually, I don't believe in the paper currency anymore.
I think, look, I'm less of a doomsday, say, in terms of currencies collapsing in countries and so on. I think these are kind of, you know, long-tail events. There's good arguments about, you know, should the dollar be as strong as it is and so on. But I think it might play a role. I think that the fact that things that we saw in South Africa, I think just from a business point of view, a lot of companies that get started, tech companies, are fintech companies, because other companies, there's not a lot of people that use e-commerce or that are online. So a lot of people use banks and money. So if you want big distribution, those are kind of things that you look at. But I think more importantly, I think a lot of us growing up in South Africa saw a lot of inequality and that kind of scarred a lot of people. And this technology is something that we all believe in that can actually address that in some way. It will never address it perfectly. And I would like to think that being South African and understanding that part of our history is actually playing a role in motivating people to build a financial system that essentially will help make the world more fair for people. So certainly that's something that drives me, but I suspect that it might be underlying some of the other motives as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. Inequality does breed innovation. I mean, if you have an equal society, a utopian sort of society, everybody just sits on their backsides and nothing really happens.
Well, either you're going to have to build it, or someone's going to make sure that it happens one way or another, the world needs to equalize a little bit.
How important has timing been in what you guys have done?
I think with all technologies, timing is everything. And look, we're still at the very, very, very early stages of this. You know, some people like to talk already about, you know, as if the game's over. Oh, but there was a bubble here. Oh, there's already these.
Yeah, I've heard people predicting the death of cryptocurrency.
No, it's very funny. There's a very good website. I think it's called 99 Obituaries. And it logs every time a major publication calls Bitcoin dead. And it now says Bitcoin has died 319 times. And this is the, you know, a Bloomberg, Reuters, those type of publications. So, I think we've at the very, very start. I think the timing has been good because we can see the traction and it's moving. But also at the same time, we shouldn't expect this to change everything overnight. You know, the existing financial system was built over hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I think one problem we have in our industry is everyone says, oh, but there's this instant gratification. You know, why can't it be faster than Visa? It needs to be, you know, cheaper than this. It needs to do X, Y, Z tomorrow. And that's okay. We will take 5 to 10 years, maybe 20 years to build it. I mean, the internet took like 30 or 40 years to really permeate. So this is a long-term project, but it's a big project and it's an important project. And that's why, you know, people like us and people joining Luno are dedicating really to some extent their lives to making this work.
So has Luno seen, because of the price, have you guys seen less interest and less transactions since the price has gone down? Because there must have been a huge bubble 2 years ago. There must have been this massive interest in everybody just changing whatever investments they had into cryptocurrencies. I heard horror stories of people doing really stupid stuff.
Yeah.
And they'll obviously be very, very unhappy and very uncomfortable now. But there must have been a slight lull after that.
No, of course. So and I mean, it's important to take these things in context. If you look over the last, you know, if you take like a 9 month time frame, that's the story. If you take a 10 year time frame, there's been about 12 or 13 of these massive cycles that people have gone through. That was just one of 13. And when you go through that cycle, two things happen. One, the price does go up and people get a little bit greedy and excited and then people want to buy. We don't like that. In fact, we try and warn our customers to say, be careful. You know, this is a new technology. It's very risky. But the other thing that happens is the media start writing about it a lot. Mm-hmm. And that generates a lot of interest in PR and then a lot more customers come into the system. So what happens typically is you have a massive group of wave of customers come in and then you get a lull afterwards. But interestingly, what happens after those lulls is there's a baseline of organic growth that lifts.
People are buying
cheap. Yeah. People buy when it's cheap, but also now people know a little bit more. Now they're more educated. Some research more. Some can tell their friends and so on. So throughout the last 5 years that Luno's been, you know, around, we have every month, every day, even if the price is flat or the price is going down, people are buying crypto for the first time.
Sure.
And nothing to do with price, you know, or some hype or whatever. So, and then again, you get these waves coming over and over
now
again.
Now, you said something interesting just now. You said the banks and the big financial institutions aren't your enemies. And you don't see them as being evil. But they are very threatened by cryptocurrency. We know this. They can pretend that they're just interested. But we know that all the banks actually are pissing a little bit because they look at this and they go, oh, well, it's almost like an alternative economy that we've got to have a stake in.
Yeah.
And even if it's just them being sensible and logical and thinking, well, better to have 1% of something than to have 100% of nothing.
Yeah, I think, look, my honest opinion is that the banks aren't pissing themselves because it's too small at the moment. The people inside the banks that understand what's going on are probably pissing themselves, but they're massively inside they're a minority.
Okay.
So most people at the bank will have a very superficial view of what crypto is, and it's a little bit dismissive, and it says
they just,
you know,
see
what?
It as another asset class.
Yeah, right? And it's so small, like we shouldn't, you know, care about it. I think the banks at the moment are more worried about Amazon and Google and things like that. But we've met a few people inside banks because we work with them a lot that went through the whole internet wave and the telco wave, and they are like panicking. But unfortunately, they're almost the canary in the coal mine. You know, they were like, we've seen this story play out before, but it's a lot of it's falling on deaf ears inside of the bank because people are saying, oh, it's so small, don't worry. And, you know, that's how a lot of innovation happens. It happens, you know, very small, these niches, there's a few people that see it. And I think at some point the banks will worry about it. And the thing with these things is it moves, you know, very, very slowly and then all of a sudden very fast. And we suspect that's the same thing is going to happen. It's not going to look like a big deal until all of a sudden one day it's a big deal.
So is Luno based all over the world? I mean, you guys have got clients all over the world, but are you based in Singapore?
Well, we were based in Singapore. We actually moved our headquarters to London because we launched in Europe. We had some new investors in Europe.
What's Singapore
and so on.
Like? I've never been. You lived there for a while.
For about 6 years.
No, what's it like there?
It
I've
is
heard
absolutely
fantastic,
fantastic. I only have good things to say about it. I mean, the basically, if you take, let's say, 40 or 50 of the smartest people in the world from different disciplines, education, town planning, science, and you give them a blank check and an island and you say, build the perfect society, you would end up with something like Singapore.
Wow.
Its major negative is that it's almost too perfect of a society. And that means certain things around, you know, creativity and the arts and they have issues around freedom of speech. It's not a completely
place, yeah.
But it's a fantastic place, and I think it's a fantastic role model for many other countries. But of course, yeah, it was, I don't know if you know the history of Singapore, but it was literally someone called Lee Kuan Yew that really had the vision and the discipline and made a lot of hard decisions to over 30 or 40 years to get it to where they were. And I think that's, you know, that's really the success. It's a person more than a country.
So where do you spend most of your time now?
Mostly in London, but traveling a lot to our teams. We have a big team in Cape Town. We've just opened our office in Johannesburg. That's grown very fast already. Yeah. We're just down the road here. And then also Singapore and Southeast Asia. A lot of travel.
Huge, huge amounts of travel.
But a lot of interesting things going on.
So your personal journey with Luno, because there's always pressure. You guys have done a tremendous job here. You've created something of massive value. But then everybody always goes, well, what's next? They keep expecting you to up the ante. Is there a lot of pressure on you to develop this product and this business and new products within the business? And do you have interests in other places that you are now looking at pursuing?
Look, again, it's still early days. I think it's very quick to call, you know, a company or people a success story. That's normally the death knell for any company, you know. So every day,
I don't mean it that way.
Yeah, but every day we're working hard to make things better. But look, the thankfully we don't have pressure from our investors, for example. They're fully supportive of what we're doing. But where the pressure always is of course with your customers. And you know, Jeff Bezos, he had a famous line where he said, "Be more scared of your customers than your competitors," because you have to make sure that you build things that they love. And I think there's a lot of things we can do to improve the user experience across many dimensions, whether it's how easily people onboard, how easily they can fund into their accounts, how easily how they can learn about it, and so on. And I think the one thing about our industry that I think has also been a little bit worrying is that there's a lot of things that we can see in, let's say, 10 years' time that's going to be super interesting and valuable. A lot of this decentralized Uber and, you know, blockchain this and so on. But the reality is there needs to be a basic critical mass of people that own crypto for all of those things to actually work.
But how far do you think we are off that?
I think we're about only like 5 to 10 years away from that.
Really?
And a good example would be, you know, we worked with some media companies to build things for people to get through paywalls with crypto, with microtransactions. And one media company said, you know, wow, this is a great thing. We'd love to launch it. How many customers do you have? And at the time we had 10,000 customers. And they said, you know what? Really, that's
too small.
Too small. Come back when you have 500,000 customers.
Well, you got your millionth customer.
Oh, we have 2.5 million.
In November
actually.
2017. Yeah. This is incredible. So the growth is now hitting that exponential curve.
So we now have 2.5 million. Now we can go back to that media agency and say, okay, now it's more interesting. But the more interesting thing is very few of those customers bought crypto to use at a paywall to read their news. A lot of them bought it because they saw it as an investment, or they maybe speculating or greedy. But when that paywall pops up and it says just one tap here, no, you know, you don't have to give anything, you can go through, that's an interesting value proposition. So
sure,
you need to do it in levels. So I think where a lot of our efforts going in still over the next 12 months is just that basic problem. You know, in South Africa it's relatively easy to get crypto, but many countries it's still hard. Like if I ask a table of random 10 people having dinner, where are you going to buy your first crypto? They wouldn't even know where to begin. Like, do you go to 7-Eleven? Do I go to my bank? When I Google it, there's all these names. Who do I trust? So I think, you know, building that whole funnel of understanding it, then making it easy to onboard, making it easy to fund. People are getting a little bit carried away trying to build things that we need in 10 years' time, when actually a lot of the work is still to be done there. And that's where most of our effort's going in, just that basic user experience and customer education.
Please tell me that you see many of these applications for blockchain ultimately finding their way into public service and into elections and into all kinds of things where we actually need to be able to trust the system. Because a lot of people are talking about how, you know, the people have lost faith in these institutions. They don't believe in them the way that they might have before. And without people believing in them, they really don't exist.
Yeah, I think we're in for an interesting next 50 or 100 years in terms of how governments work and, you know, how the financial system works. And of course, these two are quite intrinsically linked to each other. I think the technology does give us the opportunity to fix a lot of these things. I'm also realistic in that, you know, a lot of these things, it's very difficult to change an institution that's, you know, 100 years, 1,000 years old. So I suspect that most of the application will be new companies that are built or new things that are being built rather than change the old system. But what it's certainly done is it's opened people's minds. So, you know, I said to someone also a couple of years ago, even if the entire blockchain or crypto industry had to die tomorrow and it was gone, it would have still been a massive success, because what it did was it opened people's minds to what is potentially possible. Mm-hmm. And you have people like, you know, another South African-born entrepreneur, Vinnie Lingham, who's in Silicon Valley. He's built Civic, which is an identity company. But, you know, if you look at what he's trying to do, he is trying to address things like democracy and voting systems and, you know, making sure that there's transparency around it. That's his ultimate aim. So I think that, you know, the cat's out the bag now. And, you know, whether it's the technology itself, blockchain or crypto, that's going to get us to that point, or whether, like you say, it's just now the consciousness is starting to change. Either way, I think we're going to get there. But I wouldn't be able to tell you how exactly, you know, what the base route's going to be.
How much of your actual real value in terms of your own assets and like, how much do you have in cryptocurrency?
I get asked this a lot.
Apparently, I mean, it's interesting because people, you know, if you believe in it, then you would obviously be backing it and you would be knee deep in it.
Yeah. So the kind of the general answer to it, because
I'm not asking you how much you're worth. That's rude question.
No.
But I'm asking how much in percentage.
It's a small percentage, which I think is a healthy thing to do. But also, you must remember, it depends on every person. When we started the company, we didn't have money to invest in Bitcoin. I know it sounds ridiculous, but we had a bit of savings that we had, and we had to do it to pay the bills and to the servers
get
and whatever.
The company going.
Yeah. Had we taken all that money.
How long did it take Luno to become profitable?
About 2.5 years.
Did you have initial investment?
We didn't have initial, but early, we did have a small seed round that we raised, and then we did it around from Naspers and then from Balderton and RMI later, which is a big financial institution. So they are actually looking at this stuff. But yeah, so it's a percentage, but it's not large, right?
Single digits.
You know? High single digits, maybe.
Okay, no, it's just useful to know this stuff.
But I think it's important that people understand, right? Like, you know, it's and I'm not going to say to my customers, don't, you know, be careful, don't put all your eggs in one basket, and then I do the opposite of what I say. So I think, but again, you'll get variations on this. You'll get people that have a lot of disposable income that will have higher. You'll have people that are less risk averse that will have lower, and so on. But I think it's important to, you know, if it's something that interests people, it's, you know, just to, even you can buy R5 worth of Bitcoin. That's okay.
Yeah.
It's enough to kind of just get you interested and learn about it, and maybe.
Well, that's what's so nice about Luno is that you can actually just buy however much you want.
Yeah.
And then you've got whatever, you want some Ethereum, you want some Bitcoin, and you can invest some small amount, and who knows, you know, if you've got a long-term view to these things, ultimately, if you say that the technology reaches some kind of critical mass in terms of being a major volume for trading, then by the time you get to 5 to 10 years from now, that investment will have been very, very profitable.
And I think sometimes people see Bitcoin or these crypto things is like almost like a current, you know, currency in itself, and certainly in the future it might behave as a currency. But if you think about the people that are buying crypto now, they are almost investing in the infrastructure. It's like when the internet started and someone said, do you want to contribute to the building of the internet? And if it gets really big, then you own a piece of it, almost like owning property. So you can also, or similar to investing in Visa, right? Like you use Visa every day, and the more you use it, the more popular becomes, the more the value of Visa shares increase.
It's a self-fulfilling
prophecy. Yeah, but you could also buy Visa shares and then tell all your friends, you swipe your Visa card and get, you know. So there's certainly some fundamentals in terms of, you know, investment where this can go that's beyond speculation and currency.
You must have met some interesting people over the last 5 years. some lunatics as well, right?
Some very crazy people, some very sophisticated people. I think the industry, you know, there's just like any kind of world, there's you know, all different camps and schools of thought and so on. And
who's really impressed you? I mean, are there any people that have stood out that when you think back on the people you've encountered, whether it's been socially or whether it's been in terms of business, people that you just thought, wow, this is a very, very impressive person.
So I met someone a couple of weeks ago or months ago, actually, Neil Ferguson, who wrote The Ascent of Money.
Yes.
And he's a very famous historian. He's at Stanford University. Now, last week, it actually came out that he's on a board of some new blockchain project, and they're trying to build a stable coin, essentially a new currency that the world can use, that's not crypto like Bitcoin or Ethereum. It's not backed by US dollar. It's a completely new mechanism. And I think, you know, meeting someone like that is quite interesting, because this is someone who's really seen to be quite objective. He's one of the most learned people in the entire world on money. And something that we always said, you know, is that, you know, there's a lot of things that we don't know about our industry. We don't know, is it going to be Bitcoin? Is it going to be Ethereum? Is it going to scale? I don't know. But the one thing I know for a fact is that the way people think about and use money will change somewhere in the future. Why? Because if you read on the history of money, it's changed so many times. Mm. And it's interesting meeting someone like that. And which, by the way, he was actually quite a big naysayer for Bitcoin.
Oh, really?
And he,
what was his criticism?
I don't know the specifics of it, but I do know that he said that he didn't think it would work. I'm not sure what that entailed, so I don't want to kind of make things up here.
Sure.
But over time, he has actually changed his view on that, and so that's interesting when you see people that, you know, because some people, you know, people like to take their view and just, yeah, you know, stick it out. They don't care. But it also took him 5 years to change his mind on it. So something like that is, and also at the moment, he's not saying, you know, it can work for everything. He's saying it's an interesting store of value. He's not sure about the transaction side of things. He thinks the stable coins is interesting. Again, being still open-minded and curious, but at least now not just writing it off completely. So I think, you know, that's someone very interesting. But again, you know, a lot of other interesting South African entrepreneurs along the way that we've met.
Yeah, I'm just blown away by how excited and passionate you are about this stuff, because that's really what drives you and the rest of your partners in this business. And I think it's been what it has because of that energy. So Luno makes it safe and easy to buy, store, and learn about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum. And you might want to go back. Our series is still available if you want to listen to it. It's on cliffcentral.com. It's like an idiot's guide. You can hear half the people that Mark has just spoken about. Run and Ricardo, who's Monero, and a whole lot of other people. And you'll get to hear the goods, the bads, and the uglies, and also the very interesting stories of you know, how it works from the point of view of the Reserve Bank, for example. And if you like that, you might also want to go to the conference, which is, of course, happening, the Blockchain Africa Conference. You can find out more at cliffcentral.com. You need to get your tickets ASAP. Have you thought about what you're going to talk about?
At the blockchain conference. Yes.
Have I was you just listening any of that?
Sorry, I was just listening to you do the ad. We're talking about what the impact of wide-scale crypto or blockchain adoption in Africa could potentially look like. So what, you know, if there's a critical mass of people using these technologies, would it be beneficial? What would it look like? What are the risks for you know, regulators and other players and so on? But, you know, really looking at what can be the positive impact on the community, because again, we wouldn't be coming to work if it wasn't for the fact that we thought that we are going to provide a lot of value to people in their daily lives. And I don't mean just investment and making returns. Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, really making it easy to use money and cheap to use money and so on.
Yeah, you got to do good things and you got to do good. I suppose that's the plan. But it sounds like you've got your shit together, man. It's good to talk to you. No, it's very nice to meet you.
Just haven't had breakfast, but then I'll have my shirt together properly.
No problem. Marcus Swanepoel, who's the co-founder and CEO of Luno. And hope we'll see you again soon.
Thanks for the opportunity.
No, what a pleasure. Fascinating to talk to you.
This is CliffCentral.com.